Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Monday, October 21st. The Environmental Protection Agency says the Navy's water system is out of compliance after testing positive for forever chemicals in two of its wells now shut down. And got your ballot yet? We look at the matchup for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to represent Molokai and Lanai. We check in on the governor's climate advisory team 5 months into its creation. What new policies could be put in place? And we hear from a young Hawaii actor who recently wrapped up his run on the Broadway musical Les Mis. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Environmental Protection Agency says it just got the Red Hill water results back, and it's a mixed bag. It did find traces of the forever chemicals known as PFAS that are still in two wells that the military shut down following the discovery of fuel in its drinking water system back in 2021. But the current well in use got the all clear in terms of meeting the maximum to contaminant level of MCL. The EPA also tested for total petroleum hydrocarbons, or TPH. We talked to Amy Miller, the EPA's Enforcement and Compliance Director out of San Francisco, about the results and what happens next.
One of our primary goals is we want to make sure that the drinking water system is in a really good place. We want it to be resilient. We want it to be basically the best performing drinking water system on the island. And so, you know, our series of inspections have really focused on making sure that the infrastructure in the drinking water system at Joint Base Pearl Harbor is in good condition. In addition to that, one of our other tasks is to make sure long-term wise that there is no more jet fuel within the drinking water system. And as many people know, the Navy has been doing a long-term monitoring analysis, and we wanted to have some independent sampling done. And so as part of the inspection, we did do some sampling around TPH, total petroleum hydrocarbons, along with some other constituents. And we also included PFAS because we know that there is a lot of concern about perfluorinated compounds. And so we wanted to do that type of sampling as well.
So tell us, what were the facilities that you tested and what did they find?
So EPA tested the current drinking water shaft, the Waiawa shaft, but we also tested the Red Hill shaft and the Aia Halawa shaft. And we also tested the entryway into the Army system, which is a consecutive system and receives water from Joint Base Pearl Harbor. So those samples were collected and analyzed. The current source of drinking water did not have any PFAS detections above the MCL that will come into place in 2029. There were PFAS found in some of the other locations, and that is something we definitely want to know because we are working with the Navy and Department of Health overall on a comprehensive investigation into PFAS compounds at Joint Base Pearl Harbor. Along with the PFAS samples, we mentioned the total petroleum hydrocarbon samples, and we did have detections there. And we have asked the Navy to go back and resample because as part of the Navy's longer-term monitoring, we want to know what those total petroleum hydrocarbon detections are. Are they from jet fuel or are they from some other source?
And just to clarify, so the well, which is currently supplying water to the customers on the military system, did not exceed the standards, but the tests from the ones that are not in use did?
That is correct.
Okay, so they've got time to remedy that then?
There is a larger effort underway to do an investigation, and this information will obviously inform some of that effort.
And you have asked for resampling Have they done that?
I believe they are in the process. They just received our inspection report, and their response is going to be sent to us in a few weeks, but we have already had discussions with them, and they are planning to resample. And again, the whole point of looking for total petroleum hydrocarbons is, you know, and these are really, really small. They're at minute levels, and they're at such a level that our equipment cannot accurately draw conclusions as to the actual amount. It's an estimate. And so from this, we want the Navy to dive deeper, which they're doing as part of their extended drinking water monitoring plan, to see if we can determine sources. So in some instances, in other tests where they have found total petroleum hydrocarbon, they have dived deeper and found lubricants associated with some of the fire hydrants in which they have been taking the samples.
Okay, because that could skew the results as well.
That is right.
And then as far as the forever chemicals, you know, that are in the inactive water wells, are they going to have to get to a point where they're going to have to flush those again before they integrate that into the system?
They would have to do some sort of treatment. For example, a granulated activated carbon treatment, GAC, would be one way that you could treat for PFAS. And so many systems in the mainland that have concerns about PFAS have begun to do that, or they drill for additional wells to have PFAS-free water. But in instances where you don't have that option, you need to do treatment.
Well, we did use those granulated carbon filters when we initially had the spill, right?
Yes, currently there is a GAC system for the discharges that are coming out of Red Hill Shaft. And I believe the Navy has sampled post their treatment, their GAC treatment, and have found non-detect for PFAS. So it is working effectively, and that is something long-term-wise you can do to treat for PFAS.
Okay. And then is there anything else you want to add, either about this or the flow models that the military just released?
Currently, for the flow model, our technical experts are reviewing it. So at this point, I don't want to comment further on it. We are wanting to make sure that the public has access to the flow model and has a good understanding of what it is. I know that many people are interested to learn more and, you know, want to be sure that they understand how the flow model will work when considering remediation options. One thing I wanted to mention, this inspection is part of several different ways in which EPA is overseeing the drinking water system. We are also collecting split samples from the Navy as they collect drinking water samples. And we hope within this month that we will be able to post for the public to view our sample results. And we are also, we had a lab auditor go out and audit how the Navy was collecting the samples to make sure that the efficacy of the data is sound. And obviously, our oversight of the extended drinking water monitoring plan is really crucial to be able, at some point, we want to be able to get to a place that the drinking water system, we're able to say that the Navy has satisfied the regulatory agency's concern about monitoring it for the long term, and that we have not seen any jet fuel. But we're not there yet, and we need to continue to be vigilant and overseeing the work that the Navy is doing.
That was Amy Miller from EPA Region 9's Enforcement and Compliance Office out of San Francisco. She was talking to us about the recent water sampling results taken back in June. It's part of the long-term Red Hill monitoring program following the discovery of jet fuel in the military's drinking water system back in 2021. The Navy issued a statement saying its drinking water is free of JP5 or any other fuel and meets regulatory safe drinking water standards. It went on to say that since the EPA inspection, the Navy resampled our drinking water source multiple times, with results continuing to meet the safe drinking water standards.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
Join HPR for an in-person celebration of storytelling and music. Save the date to hear from Kate Tellers of The Moth Radio Hour and Boots Lupe Nui of Kohala Mountain Music Project. This event is on Saturday, October 26th from 12:30 p.m. at HPR's Atherton Studio in Honolulu. Seating is limited. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Learn more about becoming a member and experiencing art in new ways with a redesigned membership program. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Your general election ballot should have been delivered this past week. And to help you make up your mind about which boxes to check, today we have HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio in studio to talk about two candidates running for a seat on the board of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what are we focusing on today?
So we are focusing on the Molokai Lana'i race, and we have a well-known incumbent that's being challenged by a political newcomer. So the incumbent, Luana Alapa, she is a former Miss Hawaii, so she has some name recognition to her. And we have Kunani Nihipali, who is a farmer and former police officer at the Honolulu Police Department, who is challenging Luana. And what's interesting about Luana is that she ran for the first time in 2020, and she ousted Colette Machado, who was one of the longest serving trustees and the chair during that time. Machado, she did pass away in 2022, but back to the 2020 race, Luana, since it was the first time, it was very interesting because Colette, also very well known, just like Luana, Colette Machado was a longtime activist on Molokai, and but unfortunately she was the face of during when OHA was kind of getting the transparency issues raised, so that also contributed to Colette losing in 2020. And so I spoke with Jacob Aki, who is a political observer of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, and he said, like all OHA races, it's based on name recognition. So Luana and Kunani Nihipali, they're both vying to represent two islands, Molokai and Lana'i. And since OHA is a statewide race, Aki says that most of the votes are coming from Oahu.
Unfortunately, as you know, this race and most OHA races are really decided by Oahu voters. And that's always been, I think, an issue in which many Molokai residents feel that their voices are oftentimes outweighed by those who live on other islands or in counties that have a larger population. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of what else Mr. Nihipali can do. Ballots go out this week, right? So, I mean, if we're really trying to message or trying to get your name or any of your issues out there, time's ticking.
And so Luana, she didn't face as much of a crowd. She faced three challengers back in the primary election, not as much as the at-large race where Kaylee Iakina was facing more of a crowded race. But Kunani fared pretty well going up against Luana Alapa. I'm looking at the primary election. Alapa got 48.8% of the vote, which is not enough to win outright. But Kunani Nihipali was also the top vote getter. He got 29.8% of the vote. So it's going to be a wait and see what that outcome is going to be in the November 5th general election. But some background on Kunani Nihipali. He graduated from Kamehameha Schools in 1968. Then he immediately joined the Honolulu Police Department. He was also in the thick of Native Hawaiian arts issues and served as president of the Native Hawaiian Artists Guild. He was the board director of the Native Hawaiian Advisory Council. And I did find out that he unsuccessfully ran for OHA back in 1980. And Kunani was also part of the nonprofit group called Hui Malama. He did decline to be interviewed with HPR HPR, but he said in a written statement that he sent to me over text that OHA needs new leadership. And some background about Luana Lapa. She is from Guam. She comes from a military background. I believe her father was in the military, then eventually moved to Oahu. And then she says if she's reelected, she would be focusing on housing and mental health services. And some ideas that she had for housing was to create loan programs for beneficiaries, specifically Hawaiian homesteaders, to fix their crumbling infrastructures like roofs.
One area is home repairs for our beneficiaries. And a lot of it starts with the roof over their heads. And many of our homesteaders, like I said, live in old Hawaiian homestead dwellings that are currently leaking, missing roof tiles. You've got outdated roofing materials. Again, the inability to pay for a roof. And I don't know if you know, it costs at least $25,000 to repair an entire roof. And I wanted to ensure that our people would have the opportunity to do that much, so that we could do that much for them. It would be in the areas that you have the immediate results from repair of the homes. It could be like I've seen homes here in Molokai where the windows are cardboard instead, or they're missing the front porch and they have to climb around through somewhere else, or their faucets are leaking and they don't have the money to replace it. So these types of things I know we can do because we can afford to help fund these types of repairs. And that way it will help at least improve the living conditions of our people.
So Luana also said she wants to focus, if she's reelected, she wants to focus on boosting mental health services. Something that's new that I found out that she told me during the interview is that her son passed away by taking his own life about 10 months ago. And so boosting mental health services is a passion for her. But she says how she would do that, that OHA can do to support these services, is to work with other agencies, whether county or state agencies, and fund them to help their support services. So that's one thing.
It's an issue that comes close to her heart. Yeah.
Yeah. But these two candidates for Kunani Nihipali and Luana Alapa, I mean, they differ on whether or not to build the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. So Kunani has said on his website that he doesn't support the construction of the 30-meter telescope, while Luana Alapa, she says she supports pono management, but she did cite that OHA has a current lawsuit against the new Mauna Kea authority right now. So she couldn't go into detail about her stance. It's just like her answer represents the overall 9-member board as a whole. But in the money race, I mean, it's very interesting, and it goes back to Jacob Aki's point about this really is a name recognition race. So when I was looking at the campaign spending website, Luana hasn't raised any money this election period. That's between 2022 and 2024 this year. She does have a more than $4,000 deficit, and she still has to pay off a $2,800 loan. Kunani, on the other hand, I looked at his campaign spending reports. He raised almost $4,000 this election period, which is between 2022 and now. And then for this election period, he spent over $900. And going back to what Jacob Aki says, like, you have to really get your name out there. When we looked at the at-large with Kaylee Iakina and Leahu Issa, they do have to spend money on campaign ads or like having their face out there across the whole entire state. Because one thing that Aki said is that OHA is a statewide race. So a little bit about OHA. OHA is a semi-autonomous agency created to better the conditions of Native Hawaiians. They're funded by income from a public land trust, which includes land taken during the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. And the state agency is tasked with managing a nearly $600 million trust. And they are a 9-member board. So in order to get things done, you have to have the majority of the votes, which is 5. Aki says it is important for voters to pay attention to all OHA races.
Of all the OHA races, not much attention is brought up on these races. But I think what's important to note, and for the viewers who are listening, is that the issues that are affecting Molokai and Lanai are issues that I think people in general should be talking about. What are the issues that are affecting Native Hawaiians on these islands? It's things like healthcare inequalities. It's not having equitable access to air service. It's about not having economic opportunities on the island. It's about jobs. It's about infrastructure, right? So I think as we look at the issues that are plaguing these two island communities, it's important to have a candidate who may not solve the issue, but who can help be a voice for their communities at OHA to make sure that OHA is advancing and pushing these issues forward as they engage, whether it's at the state level, at the federal level, in the community, or even how they leverage their resources. Because as an island trustee, first and foremost, your kulana is to the islands that you represent.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. And I don't know, did they bring up any issues particular to Lanai?
It's mostly the same thing. So because Kunani declined to comment or an interview with us, Luana Lopez says that the current issues that are facing Lanai are the same issues that are facing Molokai, such as the housing and mental health.
All right. Okay, well, let's see what voters think in a couple of weeks. But thanks so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio about the candidates running for the OHA seat representing Molokai and Lanai. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohawaii. We are thumbing through our library in search of an early 70s Cold War spy story that rivals anything Ken Follett could have dreamed up. It's about a very unusual ship that anchored in Hawaiian waters under the cover story that it was to be used for an underwater mining operation. So the story goes they were mining for manganese nodules, and no one knew exactly what those were, but the cover story held, and some details of the ship's real mission have only emerged in recent years. The Howard Hughes design vessel was in fact a spy ship, and in 1974 it was able to steal a nuclear submarine from a depth of 3 miles in Pacific waters, 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii, a technological feat that has been compared to the moon landing. Today we're asking if you remember the name of this unusual vessel. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NāreitHawaii.com.
In recent weeks, two devastating hurricanes, Helene and Milton, have hit the continental U.S., causing billions of dollars in damages and taking over 100 lives. It is a stark reminder of how climate change is worsening storms and creating other extreme weather events. Governor Josh Green established a climate advisory team this past May to promote resilience and recovery from future climate-related disasters. The volunteer team is looking at areas ripe for policymaking, resilience when it comes to the environment and infrastructure, and recovery, both physical and financial. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Climate Advisory Team Chair Chris Benjamin and member Robin Campagnano about the group's plan for the 2025 season. Benjamin starts us off.
Our goal and our assignment is to advise the governor, and that advice will shape the administration's legislative package, but it may also shape some other recommendations that are non-legislative, maybe some executive actions he might take, and frankly, some stuff that doesn't require any legislation or executive action. So in that sense, I think we think about our time frame as being the completion of our work by the middle of January when the session starts, but leading up to that, we obviously want to have formed recommendations and be socializing those with legislators, with the governor, and with a lot of the people that we've been talking to throughout the process. We want to be doing that in the November, December timeframe so that we're not just laying a bunch of legislative proposals on the legislator's lap in mid-January. We're actually engaging and discussing the pros and cons of some of this stuff well in advance of that.
We've done over 40 meetings as a team with organizations and individuals that have been interested in this field. But I know that when we walk down the street, someone will yell out at us and call us over and have many conversations or through emails and texts. I'll get the opinions of others, many others, on similar issues. A lot of our team are engaged in other climate-related activities, and so they you know, there's just a veritable ton of information that everybody's getting. And, you know, I think we've welcomed this input because this is a community-based effort.
It was interesting to see the news that you put out once the Fire Safety Research Institute second phase report came out.
Absolutely. Yeah. We want to learn. We want to learn everything we can from the events of the past. And we absolutely would expect to incorporate a lot of those recommendations into our findings. But we are not taking any action or recommending any action that would be specifically related to remediation or compensation or anything else related to events of the past. But we definitely want to learn from them.
So one of the four pillars, right, because you have environmental, infrastructure, physical, social, and then finally financial insurance. I'm really interested in that last one because, I don't know, we don't typically think of the financial effects of climate change and kind of these future natural disaster events. So what might be some of the priorities going into the way you're thinking about that?
Well, the first thing that we want to emphasize is that the best way to reduce future losses and future costs, both loss of life and economic losses, is through resilience. The more resilient we can make our homes, our communities, the better we can manage land and the areas around our communities, the more we can reduce future losses. The far preferable thing to do is minimize the loss as opposed to just figuring out some financial structure for compensating people for loss, right? We don't want to just come up with, even though it's an important part of our work, we don't want to just come up with some sort of insurance scheme that will make people whole after the fact. We really want to focus on how do we minimize loss, because it's not just economic loss, it's also loss of life that cannot be replaced. And so it's important that we take these steps. We also want to look for, you know, insurance and financial backstops for people who do have losses, but we've got to start with trying to minimize those losses.
What does that look like?
Well, I think it's everything that we've talked about in terms of the pillars, starting with environmental resilience. There are things that we can do in the natural environment to make our communities safer. So, for example, one of the observations of the report that you referenced a few minutes ago was the management of the land around Lahaina and the reduction of fuels. Things like that can be important. Then you've got the safety of the homes that people live in. The majority of our homes in Hawaii were built before Hurricane Clips existed. And if we one of the things that we're exploring anyway is a program to try to retrofit some of Hawaii's homes to increase their resistance to hurricanes, wildfires, et cetera. That's the first line of defense for people who are in their home. If we can keep people safe in their home, then not only do we save lives, but we reduce the demand on public resources. Then there are all the safety measures that we can take through improvement of infrastructure. And then finally, I would say it's the coordination of services to get relief to people quickly in the event of a disaster. We can't prevent storms. Clearly, we want to try to slow climate change. Clearly, we want to reduce the frequency of storms. But we go into this assuming that we are going to have these events. And what can we do to minimize losses in the event that these do occur?
Particularly bringing up what it means to be like made whole after a disaster, if there are damages owed to you. Have you identified the need for future legislation to address that point?
I think the First thing that I will say is that we are still very much in the process of evaluating the magnitude of the potential problems. We've engaged an actuarial firm that is building models of potential future events, looking at the housing infrastructure in Hawaii, the commercial infrastructure in Hawaii, and doing some very sophisticated modeling to try to predict the magnitude of those financial losses. Once we have that, what we're doing is we're overlaying some of those losses on maps of various communities to understand where the most vulnerable people are and what the impact could be on them. Because I think the primary lens through which we are looking at this question is one of social justice and equity, and trying to make sure we're addressing the needs of the most vulnerable people in Hawaii.
Our firms have sort of indicated, yes, you know, we can predict that future storms are going to cost us a heck of a lot of money. And secondly, that in recent history, not only in Hawaii but throughout the mainland, not everybody's insured for wildfire or hurricane. And part of what we're looking at is, how do we take care of those that do not have insurance or are underinsured? No easy answers to that question, but it is on our radar.
Has that firm finished its model, or do you have a timeline?
We've seen early output from the model, but we have asked for a number of modifications and additional analyses, and I believe we'll be meeting with them late October to get the next round of their...
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of recommendations for the legislative session in terms of numbers? Do you have like a moonshot goal of like, this is what we want to see happen in the 2025 session?
We don't today. We're certainly moving in that direction. We're really leading with, what are the actions that we would like to see taken? What environmental stewardship actions would we like to take? What would we like to do to try to improve residential resilience? What would we like to see happen? And by the way, there's already a lot of great stuff happening to increase Hawaii's resilience to climate change. What do we think needs to be done to accelerate that, to continue that work? And then what other steps do we want to take to try to improve coordination of resources, as we've said? And there are other things too. What we have not yet done is, we've not yet said, okay, this is what we think we can accomplish in 2025 if we had X amount of dollars, and what are those dollars? I would expect that some of the work that we would recommend in 2025 would be pilots. They would be things where we would be testing on a smaller scale, ideas that we would ramp up over time. So it is possible that the 2025 needs are somewhat more modest than they would be long term. But we have to, and this is probably the most important thing that we have to communicate over the next several months, we have to recognize that our spending on climate preparation and readiness is woefully inadequate. And that statement is true for virtually every community in the country, maybe the world. That is not breaking news. But what we have to do is, we have to get all of us, you know, it's not just the legislators, because the legislators are simply representing their constituents' goals. We all have to accept that we have to invest more in protecting ourselves from these things, because I think we've been lulled into a false sense of security by the fact that the hurricanes have been bypassing us for three decades. And that's not going to always continue to happen. And so I think we're in this tough situation where the threats are significant and the perception of those threats may not match. And I think that we've got to tell that story, and we've got to be willing to start spending the money that's needed to protect ourselves.
How are you going to gauge internally the success of the climate advisory team, and how should people hold you accountable in terms of fulfilling your mission? How do you want to be judged?
It's become our kuleana to take care of the issues with which we've been entrusted. And it's a very significant task that we've tried to undertake. I think we all feel accountable to ourselves and to our own ohanas to do something. That to me is the ultimate accountability. I need to do something. I need to make a difference for the benefit of my family and the future of the state.
I especially like the parts of our discussion that really got into the nitty-gritty, the ideas, whether it was retrofitting older houses to be more hurricane-proof, like any exciting solutions and innovations that you might want to platform.
I'm a little reluctant to talk too much about recommendations, especially since they're still formative for us and we haven't briefed the governor, the legislature, and we really want to do that. That said, we do expect to be very public and open about those recommendations once they do, you know, once we're ready to put them out there. We have a website and we're going to be sharing that information. I would say that our first challenge is to identify the actions like some of the ones that you just cited that can really make a difference. And we and I keep going back to the vulnerability of some of our communities and trying to focus our efforts and make sure that they're not exclusively focused on the most vulnerable communities, but they're disproportionately focused on the most vulnerable communities. And if we can do that, and if we can get some pilots going, and we can get some good progress and demonstrate the benefits of these things. And by the way, it wouldn't just be hurricane resilience. It would be wildfire resilience and supporting. There's some great organizations, the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization, Vibrant Hawaii, who's working on developing resilience hubs. There's a lot of interest in hurricane retrofits and these sorts of things. Finding a way to really empower communities and support these organizations that are doing great work but could use more resources and more attention. Those are the things that we're going to do. Then the second part of all of this is finding the money to do it. And that's going to be tough. And we've been having conversations for a couple months about what are some of the potential revenue sources. And those are the things that we're really going to be digging into over the next month or two. And those are going to have to be two-way conversations with the legislature. We'll certainly, as a result of the actuarial work we're doing, I believe that we can say, look, if we do X, the benefit will be Y. And hopefully, and we'll, of course, prioritize the areas where that's most a most compelling investment. But ultimately, there has to be money available and there, you know, it has to be practical. We certainly hope that we can, through conversations like this and through some of the other communication work that we have planned, we hope that we can really get the message out there that it's essential that we make these investments, even if they don't have an easily quantifiable near-term payback. They are required to make our state safer.
And just one last thing, because as you've been talking about this modeling report, with any modeling study, I kind of have to ask, like, what if you're wrong?
That's a great question. And it is a sad reality that there are black swans. There are things that you don't expect. And I do know that there were a number of people sounding the alarms about wildfires, but it was not necessarily top of mind. We're surrounded by water. So we think so much about the threat of water, whether it's coming from the ocean or it's coming from underneath as the water table rises. Wind, these things are more top of mind. I do think that we are trying to make sure that we are putting in place things that will be helpful to communities regardless of what the event is. But let's be honest, we could have developed a fantastic resilience hub in Lahaina and it could have burned down if it had been in the wrong place. But that's why we want to take a multi-prong approach to try to address wind risks, wildfire risks, try to have more fire-safe communities, as well as try to have stronger buildings. But I've got to circle back to the money. It's going to take a lot of money, and we're going to have to prioritize, and we're going to have to sequence this work to some extent. And we can't get, you know, desperate or feel defeated because it's such a big undertaking. We just have to start, and we have to get to a better place a year from today than we are today, and an even better place a year from then. And as long as we're making steady progress, that's really the best we can do at this point. But the time to start is now.
Part of my optimism on this is, you know, as we've gone out and spoken to 40 plus groups, you know, throughout the state, we've also had the benefit of learning from a lot of mainland experience. You know, we're copying from the Utah Reparation Fund, the California Earthquake Authority, the Alabama Safe Homes program, and we're trying to take the best of all and learn from, you know, what's the best practices, and that's why I'm really optimistic. I think we can cobble together something that's going to be fairly well suited for the specific needs of our state.
That was Robin Campagnano and Chris Benjamin from the Governor's Climate Advisory Team talking to HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to more information about their work on the conversation page of our website after the show. And now it's time to reel in the backyard quiz answer. The late Howard Hughes is best remembered as an eccentric billionaire, but he was also an innovative designer of ships and aircraft. And a ship of his design that once operated in Hawaiian waters was certainly one of a kind. It claimed to be an underwater mining ship scouring the Pacific for manganese nodules. But in reality, it was tasked to recover a Soviet submarine that had sunk in waters 3 miles deep, 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii. Soviet vessels kept a close eye on the so-called underwater mining operation, but bought the cover story and stood by watching, clueless as it raised the remains of the sub K-129 from the ocean floor. The effort was called Project Azorian, and the CIA, in a declassified report from 2010, said that Azorian ranks in the forefront of imagination and bold operations undertaking in the long history of intelligence collection. The ship at the heart of the operation was Howard Hughes's Glomar Explorer. And congrats to Maui's Zoan Bate. You got it right. And he shared that he knew the answer because he read the book about it. But that is our quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This month marks the end of 11-year-old Milo Maharlika's run with the national touring company of the Broadway play Les Miserables. He is the second Hawaii-born actor to play the role of Gavroche, following in the footsteps of Jason Tam, who played the role on Broadway back in the 1990s. Maharlika is the first Filipino-American cast in the role, and for the last 19 months, he has portrayed the street urchin who helps revolutionaries at the barricade. The conversation's Russell Subiona got the chance to talk to Maharlika about his time on the road.
Does it seem weird for you now to not be preparing for a performance of Les Miserables?
Yeah, it kind of does feel a little weird. I remember just saying, oh, this is my last time on the barricade and stuff. And my mind still doesn't comprehend that I'm not a part of it yet.
What was your last performance like? Was it an emotional time for you? How long did it take to hit you that this was it? This was the end?
Well, my last performance, yes, it was very emotional. I cried the entire time. It hit me right before the show started. I was getting ready in the dressing room to go on, and I was like, man, I can't believe this is my last show. Mm-hmm. And I just started tearing up a little bit, but at least I had like 5 minutes or something like that to get ready, sucked it up, and yeah.
Was there like a party or something afterwards? Did they bring you like a cake afterwards? How did you celebrate with the cast?
Well, it was actually a day earlier. It's this thing called Happy Trails that we have in intermission. Mine was probably epic. It was awesome. It was amazing. So it was basically a speech / wrestling match.
I don't want to say goodbye with my words at his Happy Trails. I'd rather let my fist do the talking. So Milo, you think you're so grown up? You think you're so cool? You think you're better than everybody with your Disney shows? If you're man enough, I challenge you right here in front of this whole company to a real live wrestling match!
So we didn't really have a party right after because it was just right after. There were two shows in that day and I performed the matinee. So we only had like 2 hours, so we didn't really do anything.
What was the reason why your time came to a close? Was it a decision that you made or did your contract expire?
Yeah, my contract sort of expired. Every 6 months they ask you, oh, do you want to extend that? They usually ask you that. You don't get that choice immediately. And they just stopped asking me after that 19 months and it was my time to leave.
We talked last May. You were part of Les Miserables, the tour for 19 months. And I asked you this last year when we talked, but I think it kind of still applies now. Did it ever feel like a job? How were you able to remain enthusiastic about performing 4 shows every week?
Well, basically every time before I got ready, my dad would say, oh, Milo, don't get too robotic with it and keep it fresh every time. So that's exactly what he did. And it never really felt like that much of a job. It was just basically being myself on stage. And it was an amazing opportunity that I will never forget.
Yeah, you're definitely yourself on stage. I had the opportunity to catch a performance last year in September in California. And I got to tell you, I was very impressed. Before I went to the show, I knew there was a handful of young actors in the production. And so I thought, you know, they come up on stage, they say some lines, they sing a little bit, and they go off stage. But your role was way more complex than that. You had to navigate around people and explosions, so your timing had to be perfect. You were asked to climb up sets and to fall off of sets. I mean, you got shot, right?
Yeah.
What was the most challenging thing for you on stage?
Well, I don't really think there was something that too much challenging. It's because it's just been repeating for the last 19 months. I think if I had to pick one, though, I think it's when sometimes when it gets messed up, the flow gets like something breaks or someone messes up, it kind of messes up the flow. But I think that's the only hardest thing on stage.
Being so young and being a traveling actor, I imagine puts a different kind of stress on you than the average kid. What was the most challenging thing for you off stage?
Well, I think the most challenging thing off stage was kind of being away from my family a lot. It didn't feel great because I spent my entire life with them, and being away from them for like maybe a year was kind of challenging. So,
what was your favorite part of the whole experience?
My favorite part of the whole experience? Well, I think I have several, to be honest. My first one was meeting all the cast for the first time. They were all super talented and just genuinely very nice people. And then another time was when during layoff, we went to Hawaii, and that was amazing because we haven't been there for so long. Mm-hmm. And the lieutenant governor gave me a reward recognizing me as someone who represents Hawaii in my artistic endeavors. I think my last one near my closing, I think it was my happy trails once again. It was so fun. And it was kind of a bittersweet ending saying goodbye to all these people. But it was also exciting to start a new adventure here in LA.
What was your favorite city to perform in? Was there a particular one that you were really excited about?
Well, I have a lot of favorite cities. I really liked, I'll just name them off the top of my head. Washington, D.C., performing at the Kennedy Center, which is super historic. Dallas, which I got to eat the world famous barbecue. And then I got to go to Memphis, learn more about Elvis Presley at Graceland. We also got to go to New Orleans, where we celebrated Mardi Gras because we were right during that time. And then I even went to Cleveland, went to the Christmas Story House, which was amazing, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Center. And I also got to go to Philadelphia, where I ran up the Rocky Steps, which was amazing. So I don't think I generally have just one favorite. I love them all.
Do you think that you had an impact on other AAPI actors and artists?
Yeah, I think I did, because considering I'm the first Gavroche to be Filipino, Asian American, Pacific Islander, that was a huge opportunity for me. And I loved performing for all of those people who wanted to be like my character or be an actor like me who have the same skin tone as me. And that was just very inspiring.
Did you get to meet a lot of people, a lot of other Filipinos or a lot of other Pacific Islanders after the show that came because they knew there was a Pacific Islander in the cast?
Yeah, a lot of my family came to watch the show in like Seattle. My dad watched it so many times, but also sometimes we come early, right before the show, and we walk past the stage door, and I see a bunch of people saying, oh, I heard there's a Filipino, Asian American, Pacific Islander who's playing one of the main roles in the company. So, yeah, I think I did.
What do you think you'll miss the most about this experience?
The thing I think I'll miss the most about this experience is just playing that role, which was an amazing experience for me, and also inspiring so many people, which I will continue to do here in LA in my art. And I want to get back to like doing NFTs and making music and being in more movies and TV shows. And I have lots of goals and achievements for a while. And yeah, I'm going to miss Les Mis a lot.
Milo, thanks so much for your time, man.
Thank you. You too.
That was 11-year-old actor Milo Marjalico talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Marjalico recently ended his 19-month run as Gavroche in the national tour of Les Misérables. Well, that does it for us today. We're out of time. Tomorrow, we plan to check in with the latest potentially tight races in the upcoming election as we get down to the finish here. Do you have an idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.